it's a tremendous opportunity to build a better world. I mean, there's not like the world we live in is like perfect. We can do better than what we've got. My hope is that we can use this moment of cataclysmic change to build a better world. And I do think that is within our grasp.
Welcome back to Cambridge Forum's Living on Borrowed Time, a discussion about the precarious state of the planet with guest Jeff Goodall, the best-selling New York Times author and contributing editor at Rolling Stone, where he's been covering climate change for over two decades. He's authored several books, and the latest is The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. We also welcome Mike Flanagan, who's the scientific director of the Canadian Partnership for Wildland Fire Science. Welcome to you both.
Great to be here.
Happy to be here.
You raised some really good points, Jeff, in the book. You talk about the scale and the implications of a hot planet. Well, parts of, obviously, this hits the poorest people. There are lots of people die in their apartments in poor sections of America just because they don't have an air conditioner. But then there's parts of the world where you can't go in the shade because the shade is still a heat risk. So, you know, those places, there is no real escape.
Well, I mean, you don't have to go very far to find that. You can find that on the east side of Austin here. I spent a lot of time in Phoenix in housing projects where, you know, low income people live. And, you know, there's no trees. It's just asphalt, concrete. And, you know, and you mentioned people who don't have air conditioning, and which is certainly true. There are billions of people on this planet who don't have air conditioning and for all intents and purposes never will, even if we, you know, democratize the air conditioning in some ways and subsidize the costs of buying and running air conditioners. For all kinds of obvious reasons, there are billions of people who aren't going to have air conditioning. But what I find most upsetting and, you know, the kind of unknown risk that I wrote about in my book is people who have air conditioning, but don't have much money and can't afford to run it, or they can only afford to run it for an hour or so a day. And so they're constantly making a kind of arbitrage of like, do I want to have enough money to buy dinner or pay my rent? Or do I want to run my air conditioner for two more hours? And, you know, for some people, that's not a big issue. But for a lot of people who are in those kinds of situations, who have other health problems and things, that is a kind of death arbitrage. Because if you calculate that wrong and you don't turn the air conditioning on and your room, your temperature in your apartment goes up to 105 degrees and it stays there, you know, for a day or so, and you're not in great health, you're in big trouble. So, you know, we don't have to go far to see the extreme risks that these kinds of heat events bring to us as a society.
So extreme weather conditions around the globe are interconnected and insidiously self-accelerating. How is what's happening in the Arctic affecting air currents and the jet stream and these wild fluctuations of temperature and precipitation?
Maybe I'll talk briefly about extreme fire weather and climate change and then try and answer that question. Okay, so fire is driven by the extremes. If a fire starts on an average summer day and it's an unwanted fire, it's easy for fire to manage to put out. It's on those hot, dry, windy days. We call them spread days because that's when fires actively spread. In Canada, 3% of our fires burn, 97% of our area burned. It's even more dramatic in Western United States, where 1% of the fires burn, 99% of the area burned. And those 1% happen on just a relatively small number of days of hot, dry, windy conditions. Those are what's driving. And that's what we've been seeing in Canada this fire season. And we've done research around the globe. Many areas of the globe are seeing more hot, dry, windy days. And with climate change, we expect this to continue. I mentioned earlier, Jeff, that fire and temperature are intimately connected. And there's three reasons for this. The first is the warmer it gets, the longer the fire season is. And that's very important for places like Canada, where our summer season, our fire season is relatively short. In California, they talk about fire year now. They don't call it a fire season because fires burn all year long. Second, the warmer it gets, the more lightning we see. And lightning is responsible for most of our area burned in Canada. And unlike human-caused fires that are preventable, we really can't do much about lightning until we deal as a society with human-caused climate change. And, you know, the third reason is as the temperature increases, its ability to suck moisture out of the fuel, and here I'm talking about dead fuels in the forest floor, cured grass, dead needles and leaves, increases almost exponentially with temperature. So unless you see more rainfall to compensate from this for this drying from the warming, we're going to have drier fuels. And this is another critical piece to understand wildland fire. The drier the fuels, it's easier for a fire to start, easier for a fire to spread. And it means there's more fuel available to burn, which leads to higher intensity fires, bigger flames, which means they're challenging to impossible to extinguish. So that's what climate change is bringing to forest fires. Now, climate change is also affecting our weather patterns, and our weather patterns really dictate the fire situation. There's something called omega block, and it's like the Greek letter omega, and it's just a high pressure system. And it's the opposite of your grade three water cycle. Air is sinking, warming, and drying. So it dries out all the fuels that stays there for a while. And the stagnant pattern is tied to the jet stream. So the jet stream gets its energy from the temperature difference between the Arctic areas and the equator in the Northern Hemisphere. The Arctic is warming at 3 to 4 times the rate of the rest of the globe. So that temperature difference is getting smaller. So instead of a fast flowing river with our surface pressures, highs and lows going through every 3 to 5 days, and the low pressures bring rain every 3 to 5 days, you don't have a fire problem. But that river gets lazy and you get eddies and whirlpools, and then you get those omega blocks forming and stagnation. You get drought and fire where they are, and where the low pressures are, you get rain and flooding. And we're seeing record-breaking flooding this year in the United States, and right now it's occurring in Greece. They're talking about 2 feet of rain in Greece from a Metacane, which is kind of like a Mediterranean hurricane. It's just crazy. And there's a recent paper out showing that the change from drought to flooding is increasing in how fast it's happening and how severe. And this is really important because when you have a drought, the soil gets like hard pan. And so when it does rain, it doesn't soak in, it just runs off. So this is what we're seeing, is a warmer world with this lazy jet stream causing more extremes at both ends of the spectrum. Heat, drought, fire, one end, and rain and flooding at the other end.
I'm just going to field some questions that have come in from the audience here. I'm not sure if we can answer them all, but let's try. What does getting our act together mean when the changes in the atmosphere and ocean appear to be already set up by the current levels of carbon dioxide?
So to deal with human-caused climate change, we have to stop burning fossil fuels. Okay, that's the first thing. And we have to go to renewables. And there's lots of options. And it's becoming more economically viable for these renewables as opposed to conventional fossil fuels. You know, the insurance industry is coming into play here too, because it's no longer economically viable to protect through insurance people's homes in various parts of the world now because of increasing nature of disasters. But we need individuals, we need local government, municipal governments, federal governments, global society, industry. We all have to start doing our part, and some of it is not going to be pleasant. You know, if we have to reduce our carbon footprint. And, you know, what does that mean? It means less air travel. Private planes should be essentially banned except for essential use. You know, there's just so many ways that we are adding greenhouse gases. And then there's things that the unknown unknowns. Methane is increasing much faster than carbon dioxide. And carbon dioxide, our current levels, we haven't seen for 3.5 million years, okay? Methane is 20 to 80 times more effective as a greenhouse gas, and it's increasing dramatically. Is it because of permafrost thaw? There's hydrates, primarily methane, and terrestrial and seabed permafrost. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty as where this is coming from, but we really have to stop burning fossil fuels. All right, that's the short answer. There's other ways that contribute, but that's the big one. Over to you, Jeff.
Well, I agree with everything you said. I would just underscore, we do need to stop burning fossil fuels as soon as possible. But I also think it's important to underscore that every molecule of CO2 that is kept out of the air is progress, right? And so it's, you know, I think that people can get into a kind of doom loop that think, oh, we're never going to get off of fossil fuels. And so we're just completely screwed. And, you know, let's just go hide in the basement and, you know, scrawl on the wall in crayons about, you know, the fate of human civilization. You know, the fight is really important because every coal plant that is shut down, every, you know, barrel of oil that stays in the ground is a better world for the future. And so this, it's not, there's no kind of binary here, right? That's really important to grasp. And I also would underscore that, yes, it's important to do our parts. Yes, it's important to live a low carbon lifestyle, all of that. But this is a political problem, and we need political action. We need to be pulling the big levers, which is eliminating carbon subsidies, more transparency on lobbying costs, and working on dismembering the political muscle of the fossil fuel industry to help accelerate all of these other kinds of progress of towards faster uptake of renewable energy and things like that. I just would underscore that this is really about, I think, about politics and political change, which is why voting, political activism, and all that is so important.
Somebody else asked here, Edward, what can climate change have? What effect, I guess he means, have on the major oceanic currents which affect weather events?
Well, I'll take a quick stab at that. I mean, ocean currents are hugely important in our weather and our climate. You know, the ocean is a big heat sink. 90% of the heat that is accumulated on in the atmosphere has gone into the oceans. There's a lot of concern about a central circulation system, a kind of Gulf Stream circulation system called the AMOC, that works off similar to the way the jet stream working off the temperature differentials between the poles and the equator. There's a similar kind of, you could think of it as a jet stream in the ocean that works off of similar temperature differentials. And there's concerns about that slowing down. And if that slowed down, that would have a profound impact on the climate, especially in the Northern Hemisphere. There's a lot of study around that, a lot of uncertainty around that. There have been some studies that just came out in the last 6 months or so that suggested that circulatory system is beginning to slow down. But there's still a lot of unknowns about the ocean. It's vitally important to our climate system. I don't know, Mike, do you have anything you want to add?
Well, just as Iceland and Antarctica melt, there's a lot more fresh water, which also complicates the circulation right. system.
Someone called Rich says, are you anticipating wide swathes of the continent to become uninhabitable with weeks-long heat waves if an area loses power? It's kind of hard to predict, isn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly virtually any hot place, if an area loses power, is going to be in tough shape for as long as it takes to get that power back up. Uninhabitable usually means sort of a kind of longer term kind of problem. I mean, but the big issue with questions like this, which are important, is uninhabitable for who, right? I mean, there's a vast differential in people's ability to deal with extreme heat and all kinds of extreme climate impacts, depending on, you know, how much money you have, how mobile you are, how good of health you're in. You know, it's not a equally distributed risk, whether it's extreme heat or flooding or drought or whatever. People's risks are very different. So when we think about this question of, you know, will it be uninhabitable or not, or how will it affect us? The real difficult part of that question is, who is the us or the we that we're talking about?
It's interesting because, you know, since the 2021 heat event in the Pacific Northwest and British Columbia, I'm getting emails from people. So it's on people's minds. Where can I go to avoid the heat? where can I live to avoid the smoke? So this is now part of our consciousness, which, you know, I wasn't getting emails like this until recently. So it is affecting the way people think.
You were talking about who's responsible for this. Well, you're totally right about the government failing to act and moving, forcing fossil fuel companies to meet targets, in fact, letting them off. There was an opinion piece in The Guardian last month which went after the worst climate offenders, which in fact are the super rich. No surprise there. It has been shown that the world's wealthiest 10% are responsible for 40% of global emissions. So think of the ramifications of that 10% of the population changed their ways, the instant impact it would have on almost half global emissions. While emissions from low and middle income groups within rich countries declined, trying to do the right thing. Is there a way that either of you can think of for us to go after the chief offenders, maybe by taxing their superfluous private planes or the vast houses with infinite air conditioning? Any thoughts?
That's a hard one. You know, I think it's important that we tax carbon, and that's what we do in Canada and in British Columbia. And it's much more effective than some of the other techniques. So you want to use carbon, you pay for it. And the more you use, it should be on an accelerated scale. You pay a lot more. At least that's a starting point. But I think private jets should be banned, you know, to a large degree. But I'll stop there before I get
good luck trouble. With that.
Yeah.
Good luck. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Well, I think that study that you've cited that has been widely quoted, you know, of the top 10% of the income earners being responsible for 40% of carbon pollution is really important because, first of all, it cuts against this argument that is often made that there's just too many people on the planet. And, you know, certainly having 7 or 8 billion people on the planet, you know, matters a lot in all kinds of ways for biodiversity and land use and all kinds of ways. But when you look at it from a carbon point of view, the real problem is not too many people. It's too many people is a smallish number of people consuming way too much. You know, I did a lot of reporting in my book in Africa and in India, and, you know, both of places which have booming populations. But the carbon footprint of people in those places is minuscule compared to my carbon footprint. And I live very low carbon lifestyle by most American standards. I have a heat pump in my house. I have a small house. I drive a hybrid car. I ride my bike everywhere. I mean, do all these sorts of things. But then when you think about the super rich or even the medium rich who have, you know, 10,000 foot homes, fly private jets around, have 6 SUVs in their garages, then you see why there is political tension between the wealthy North and the developing South in global climate negotiations. Because basically, you know, and in my view, rightfully so, and why this is such an economic and social justice issue is because the global South, the developing world, is saying, hey, you guys are the ones who are causing the problem. And not only are you causing it by your private jets and your 10,000 square foot houses, but because CO2 is a historic problem also, because CO2 stays in the atmosphere, you guys have used up all of the space in the atmosphere. And we're getting all the impacts down here. We're having crop failures. We're having droughts. We're having extreme heat waves, all of these problems. We're not wealthy enough to deal with this. You cause the problem, so you need to help us pay for this. And one of the central friction point in international climate negotiations right now is what does the wealthy North owe the developing South for these impacts? You know, there's this thing called the Green Carbon Fund that has $100 billion in it that never quite, the North never quite ends up funding the way they should. But this question of equity and justice is fundamental to how we think about moving forward, not just with solving climate change, but with how we deal with the equity and fairness issues that are at the heart of this problem.
Very good point, that we're all dumped on unfairly. They're getting a great deal more. You know, some of the islands are being completely destroyed, and these people have almost contributed nothing to the problem. It seems very wrong. You're listening to Cambridge Forum's Living on Borrowed Time, a discussion about the precarious state of the planet with guest Jeff Goodall talking about his new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet, and Professor Mike Flanagan, who has a research chair in predictive services, emergency management, and fire science at Thompson Rivers University in British Columbia, Canada. Of course, some people are doing good stuff. You know, architects are designing better houses, smaller houses, heat pumps, solar panels, trying to be off the grid as much as possible. I mean, some people are going great guns and getting rid of asphalt in areas, putting more trees in. I mean, all this stuff takes time. But really, the chief problem is taking carbon out of the air, right? We've got to get the carbon out of the air somehow. Any suggestions about what methods are most promising?
Well, I'll take a quick stab at this. I would say the first problem is not getting carbon out of the air. The first problem is stopping putting it into the air. That's what's important, right? Mm-hmm. So we need to stop putting billions of tons of carbon into the air every year, right? And then once we stop doing that, then we can start to think about taking carbon out of the air. But until we stop putting it in, the idea of taking it out is very problematic. And there is a kind of growing industry in Canada and in the United States of carbon removal systems that are basically giant machines that kind of act like trees and suck CO2 out of the atmosphere. And the idea is you pull it out of the atmosphere and then you bury it underground, geologically sequester it. And, you know, in 100 years, that may in fact be a really important technology. But right now, it's really, really expensive. It doesn't work anywhere near the scale. The scaling problems are enormous. And it's basically becoming a tool to allow the fossil fuel industry to continue to give the fossil fuel industry a kind of license to continue to operate, to say that we can create carbon-free oil, which is basically we'll continue to, you know, pump the oil out of the ground and burn it, but we're going to build these other machines that are going to suck the CO2 out of the ground, so it's okay. And that is not a big step forward.
Mike, do you want to add to that or no?
Just that, you know, it may be the courts that may play a role here, just like they do with big tobacco, because big oil has known for years that burning fossil fuels would warm our planet. And some of the research they did was pretty well bang on as about how much warming we'd see. So they knew they're responsible, and I expect the court cases to start rolling in.
That's a great point. I just want to underscore one thing, which is I think that's really true. And I wrote a chapter in my book about the kind of growth of attribution science that, you know, scientists are now able. It used to be when we talked about these extreme events, people like Jim Hansen of NASA, the kind of godfather of climate science, would use the metaphor of loaded dice, right? That, you know, yes, as we put more CO2 in the atmosphere, it makes these wildfires or these droughts or these extreme heat events more likely, but we can't say that it actually is responsible for any particular one. Well, with attribution science, and I won't go into the details of it, you can read it about it in my book if you want, but we're able to much clearer say, no, this was caused by higher levels of CO2. In fact, and not every event can they point their fingers to, but the heat wave in the Pacific Northwest was one that they were able to point to and say, basically, this would have been impossible without the additional CO2 in the atmosphere. So once you can make that link and say, okay, this particular event was caused by the additional CO2 in the atmosphere, which came from burning fossil fuels, then what Mike is talking about this kind of litigation, and you begin to think about the oil industry much more like you thought about the tobacco industry. And I think that is absolutely, I agree, the sort of future of where things are going with this.
Well, we actually did a program on this last year. So if anyone missed it, you should pull it up, called the 64-Year Climate Change Cover-Up with Jeff Dembicki, who's another Canadian journalist, who looked into this and actually got all the papers showing that Mobil and Exxon had all this research 64 years ago. Good science showing the temperature increases, and did exactly what the tobacco industry did, contorted it, put a spin on, well, we can't be sure, or it might happen or it might not happen. And so it was buried So they definitely have the pockets to fill the problems, solutions for sure. So there've been a lot of very good comments and questions. And somebody said, how do we get generally people to care about the future?
You know, one of the questions I get is there any hope? And I still have some hope. It's dwindling. Okay. And, you know, as I've been studying climate change for decades, and originally I was concerned about my children's future, or now my grandchildren's future. But now I'm thinking about my future, and, you know, I'm not a spring chicken anymore, that it's going to have dramatic impacts on us. But I'm still hopeful that human behavior, we can change. And sometimes it takes bloody noses. And so we're getting the bloody noses. We're getting multiple bloody noses. So it's time for us to act. So hopefully we have the will and the wherewithal to act.
Well, Jeff, you quoted W.B. Yeats in your book, paraphrasing, before there was light, there was heat. It's the origin of all things and the end of all things, which was a bit apocalyptic there. But what do you feel?
In the way I quoted that, I didn't certainly didn't mean it to be apocalyptic. I'm not a doomer at all. I don't feel like we're living through an apocalypse. I feel like we're living through one of the greatest challenges that humans have ever faced. I feel like, you know, before we can really talk about solutions in any kind of meaningful way, we have to really fully understand the scope and scale of what we face, which is why work that people like Mike do, and the reason I wrote this book, is to try to help people understand the scope and scale of what we face. But I also feel like this is a moment of tremendous opportunity, because so much is up for grabs. You know, we are going to have to, and we are going to change our energy system. We're going to change how we get energy. We are going to change how we build cities. We are going to change how we grow food and where we grow food. All this stuff, you know, is going to happen. And if I think, because there's so much at stake, if we get politically involved, if we get active in helping to shape this future, it's a tremendous opportunity to build a better world. I mean, there's not like the world we live in is like perfect. I mean, every time I drive by a strip mall here in Austin, I'm like, oh my God, this place is horrific. You know, I mean, we can do better than what we've got, right? And I think that my hope is that we can use this moment of cataclysmic change to build a better world. And I do think that, you know, that is within our grasp.
I'd like to think that we can leave the world in a better place than when we found it. And so far we're failing. We're failing miserably at it, but there's opportunity. I agree 100% with you, Jeff.
Well, I'm glad we were able to end on a slightly optimistic note. You know, if enough good people do the right thing, that's basically what it takes for change to shift. So I'd like to thank both of our amazing speakers today. Jeff Goodall, talking about his new book, The Heat Will Kill You First, Life and Death on a Scorched Planet. And Professor Mike Flanagan, who is a research chair in emergency management and fire science at Thompson Rivers University in British Columbia, Canada. Cambridge Forum is made possible through the generosity of Herbert and Dorothy Vetter, the Lowell Institute, Mass Cultural Council, Cambridge Community Foundation, and of course, all of you. So if you want to donate or sign up to our list, please visit the website, cambridgeforum.org. Thank you all for joining us, and I hope to see you all soon.